Why do humans hold on to stuff, oddments we don't use, and yet can't quite throw out? It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? I'm Annabelle Crabb. Come and have a rummage through the story of us told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
There was a time when I was so completely wrapped up in you that no conversation but yours could give me any degree of pleasure. Your footsteps upon the quarterdeck over my head took me from my book and brought me upon deck to walk with you. Often, I fear, to your great annoyance. Lee, I did not actually pen that torrid letter to you, as much as I would obviously like to have. It's actually, weirdly, Matthew Flinders. Yep, the colonial explorer and the first white person to circumnavigate Australia. Writing to his, what would we call him, his friend, George Bass, in 1800.
Okay, Alicia, please tell me I can hear more from this letter. I love a good homos in history story.
Oh, Lee, I knew that you would love it, and I do have more. In fact, I have a whole new read on Matthew Flinders for you. This is The Dead Can't Sue. I'm Alicia Simmons.
And I'm Lee Boucher.
And we're a couple of very serious historians letting loose in an ABC studio, gossiping about dead people from Australia's past because, well, it's in the name, The Dead Can't Sue. Each week on The Dead Can't Sue, Lee, we're going to tell stories about the dead. Some weeks I'm going to be the captain of the ship to continue on the Flinders metaphor and bring you the story of someone's life and every dirty detail that I've managed to dig up about them. And then on other weeks there'll be a mutiny and you'll get to be the captain.
And no doubt we'll be wearing sexy naval officer uniforms throughout.
I could imagine nothing less. There will be people that you've heard of, whether that's Flinders or Bennelong or Dame Nellie Melba. But the thing that we're doing, I promise you, is giving you a new lens through which to look at them, and you will never see them in the same light again.
And then some weeks we'll tell you about someone because their life was, well, just plain bonkers.
We're going to begin with two episodes looking at one of the major figures of Australia's early colonial history.
Can't wait.
Matthew Flinders was the first Englishman to circumnavigate Australia. Mm-hmm. He named a lot of stuff and has plenty of stuff named after him. And if you dig a little deeper, then you discover a side to Matthew Flinders, which we'd never really seen before. And I think as well, a softer side to him and George Bass. So the letter that I started the episode with was only published in 2002. And this Flinders is far from the rough and tumble world of frontier masculinity in which we tend to imagine him. There are some chaps with maps who just love to pen an erotically charged letter to each other.
Sounds like fun.
I mean, this was an age of sensibility, and Matthew Flinders is a man of exquisite sensibility. He embodies his age.
With a lot of heated erotic attachments. Alicia, I cannot wait for you to help me understand these attachments, understand how they work in his world, how they make sense in this kind of 18th century landscape, and indeed helping you to understand how does one even become one of the world's most accomplished navigators?
They are great questions, Lee. So, in fact, Flinders is born in Donnington, Lincolnshire, on England's east coast in 1774. His dad was a surgeon and he wants Flinders to follow in his path. But Flinders takes to the sea instead, entering the Royal Navy when he was just 15 years old because of, and I love this, books.
Oh.
Okay, so In Flinders' words, he said that he was, and I quote, induced to go to the sea against the wishes of my friends from reading Robinson Crusoe.
Wow.
I mean, we just love people who are compelled to action via reading. I mean, look, this is at least what he told a magazine who were doing a bio of him when he was much older.
What little I know about kind of late 18th century Britain, I often think about kind of stories about naval heroes and naval captains. They're front and centre of the kind of British imaginary. They're like the AFL football stars of the late 18th century. Have I got that right?
You are absolutely right. And look, the Pacific Voyages of Discovery, from Captain Wallace to Captain Carteret to Captain Cook, which Flinders is no doubt reading, are really the Netflix series of their day.
Yep.
I mean, the journals from these voyages are printed in a compendium called Hawksworth's Voyages, by a guy called Hawksworth, and it's an absolute bestseller. Mm-hmm. Every middle-class family has a copy of it on their bookshelves. Mm-hmm. Look, there is so much around the Pacific at that stage and around naval, you know, activity. You've got two theatrical productions about the Cook voyages, one called The Death of Captain Cook, the other called Oh My, A Trip Around the World, that's a pantomime. And they are playing on repeat at Covent Garden for years. Mm-hmm. You've got wallpaper depicting the Cook voyages that posh families put up in their lounge rooms. So you can imagine little Matthew Flinders sitting up on his bed, reading Robinson Crusoe and listening to all the excited chatter that's going on around him about voyaging to exotic locales. So, of course, he'd like that over medicine, right?
Mm-hmm. And how did his father feel about this? Do we know?
I know. Well, look, I mean, his father, obviously, as I said, didn't want him to follow in his footsteps. But from Flinders' perspective, and you've got to imagine, surgery back then doesn't mean what it does today.
Yep.
So we're not talking about a surgeon's son, as you would have it today, who's growing up in some posh suburb and wants to drive the same Mercedes that his father drives.
So it's not the son in Wallara, like going to the private school and kind of, it's not a world of privilege in the same way that we would understand
it. It's really not. To be a surgeon back then, look, medicine is yet to be professionalised.
Yep.
And so to be a surgeon meant that you were really part of the middling orders in life. You were not a gentleman, okay? And one of the things that we know about Flinders is he wanted to be a gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
And one of your passports to social mobility in the 19th century was the Royal Navy.
Yep.
If you could become a lieutenant, then you're in. So he's ambitious, but he's not that unusual at the time. You've got so many wars going on in this period. The Royal Navy, in fact, increases in this period to 140,000 in 1815. Remember, by then, you've got the Napoleonic Wars that have just started.
Yeah, so there's that kind of late 1780s, early 1790s period. There's the French Revolution. It's a period of kind of tumult in Britain. Like, Matthew Flinders is growing up in a world where political orders are being turned upside down. People in Britain are scared about what's going to come across the channel. And then we know that this becomes the Napoleonic Wars. But at this point, it's just the French Revolution scaring the bejesus out of Britons and also Britain's navy expanding out into the wider world. So tell me, he's having these boyish fantasies about naval adventures. Does life at sea measure up these Robinson Crusoe fantasies?
Look, I think that we can imagine it through Flinders' eyes. There's no doubt that seeing London for the first time and travelling the world would have been exciting.
Mm-hmm.
But the daily routine would have been tough, you know, damp to say the least, and difficult. You can imagine being on a ship in England. You've got cold sprinting winds, you've got monotonous British food, you've got salt pork, salt beef. We're not talking prosciutto and bresaola.
Oh, okay.
You're imagining rubbery gristle. You've got dark, crowded quarters, no one showering or putting deodorant on. They're climbing the rigging to terrifying heights. You've got rats, you've got vermin. But in spite of all this, Matthew apparently liked it.
Look, I've got some sympathy. I don't mind a room full of smelly men in close quarters. That can be a good time. But, you know, you do want a shower at the end. But, like, I'm with Flinders here. This sounds like a hoot.
Cut out the vermin.
Yeah.
And like, you have a good Saturday night.
Yeah, Saturday night on Oxford Street. It's a good time.
Absolutely. Look, his father said he loved it, and his father was very devastated when he moved out. But Matthew Flinders returns at the age of 17. Isn't that young by today's standards when you think of things? But anyway, he's returned at the age of 17 and his father writes, He's grown and much altered by his uniform and dress. He appears satisfied with this situation. I pray to God that he may be prosperous. Mm. And we can hear a clap of thunder sounding in the distance there. So his first journey is to Tahiti in 1791. He's still age 17 and he's on Captain William Bligh's second attempt to transport breadfruit from the South Pacific to the West Indies. He leaves the UK, sails to Tenerife, jogs down to South Africa, scoots across to Van Diemen's Land, pops in at Tahiti and other Pacific islands, and then whooshes across to Jamaica.
Oh, this sounds like the classic Pacific cruise. I'm in.
Quite expensive. Mm. Flinders is a great travel correspondent, and his letters back to his patron, Captain Paisley, are really a delight. He makes friends, you know, as Flinders tends to do. He's a very sociable guy with two botanists on board. They're called James Wiles and Christopher Smith, and he really thrills to the scientific aspects. But war breaks out again with France, and Bligh is ordered to return to England because they need his boat. So there's Flinders. He's now 19 years old. And portraits of him show a pretty attractive guy, to be honest. He's 5'7" tall. He's got a slim, wiry body, dark curly hair, alabaster skin, chiseled features, a jutting chin, small mouth, and very dark, bright eyes with a kind of marsupial gleam to them.
Look, not my cup of tea, but for those who don't mind a little bit of Timothée Chalamet, Flinders might be right up your alley.
Absolutely. He sees his first battle in 1794 at sea. So there he is. He's out there. He's gone from this paradisical island, you know, I mean, not just Tahiti. He's also been romping around Jamaica. To suddenly being in the English Channel.
Yeah, okay.
So pretty tough. So there he is. He's in squalls, in rough seas at night. You've got cannonballs. You've got black smoke. You've got flashes across the water. You've got the roar of guns. And boom, he witnesses his friend and his patron, the captain of that voyage, Captain Paisley, getting his leg shot right off in front of him.
Oof, this, now, he's not on a Tahitian beach anymore.
No, quite far from it. So he's standing there covered in gore and pretty much decides at that moment to commit to the exploratory arm of the Navy rather than the military one.
I endorse this decision, Flinders.
Yes, I think we can understand where he's coming from. So the problem is he's now without a patron, but his friend Wiles introduces him to the famous botanist and uber wealthy Joseph Banks, who sailed on the Cook voyages and who we shall call from here on in. What should we call him?
I reckon it's Big Daddy Banks, surely.
I think that's correct. You know, and it's important at this time just to give patronage some kind of a. Or for people at home who aren't aware of what patronage is, it's basically a system where wealthy individuals like Banks. And Banks is born into one of the most affluent families in Britain. I think he's in the top 400, I read somewhere. So they provide financial support or jobs to artists, voyagers and politicians in exchange for loyalty, flattery, prestige. If you've ever wondered why everything in Australia is called Banks, Blanks, Bankstown, you know, so many things named after him, that is why. So it's a system that's basically based on social inequality and it begins to change in the late 18th century with the shift to a commercial market economy where your income's supported by sales rather than by a patron.
But the world that Flinders is in is a world where your charm, being able to get along well with your patron is kind of part of what you need in life. Is that right?
It's part of what you need in life, but it's also changing. Yeah. Flinders is in a world of flux.
Yeah.
Actually, it's in the late 18th century that you have the commercial market economy growing, and we see that in Flinders' letters. Later on, when he's in Australia, he starts to see how much money commercial traders are making. And he goes, I'm sick of working for a pittance, he says at some point, and always being, you know, kind of beholden to my patrons. I want to break out on my own. So yeah, he's really in between these two periods.
Yep.
So Banks gives Flinders an introduction to the British Admiralty. So Flinders is now about 21. Mm-hmm. He ends up on the HMS Reliance, which is a ship bound for Port Jackson, aka Sydney Harbour. And it's carrying its new governor, John Hunter. Flinders is ecstatic. He later writes that he was, and I'm quoting him, led by his passion for exploring new countries, to embrace the opportunity of going out upon a station, which, of all others, presented the most ample field for his favourite pursuit.
And remind me what his favourite pursuit is again, Alicia?
His favourite pursuit is obviously George Bass.
Yeah, sure.
As we know. So it's on this ship that he meets George Bass. And for listeners, that name is probably ringing a bell. We'll get there soon. Bass is obviously the recipient of that saucy letter that I read to you earlier.
So Bass is a surgeon. Why is a surgeon on a ship?
Look, surgeons were on most ships, and that's a few reasons. Firstly, you've got randy sailors popping into Pacific Islands and spreading venereal disease. Huge problem, really tragic. So the British start to get kind of concerned about that. You've also got scurvy from not having enough fresh fruit and vegetables. Banks's journals are quite delightful, the extent to which any minor ailment, he's convinced he's got scurvy.
Yep.
And he says, I flew to the lime juice, I flew to the lemon juice. On this ship, we also have Bennelong, who you'll meet in another episode of The Dead Can't Sue. He spent many months in England. He's now depressed, he's gloomy, he's quite ill. And he's actually on that voyage. Bass tends to him.
Right. Am I reading this right? Is this the meet-cute between Flinders and Bass? Is that what I'm about to hear?
I think you're absolutely right. And we can imagine that moment. There's Bass, he's 24 years old, 3 years older than Flinders. He's tall. 6 foot tall, very strong, very handsome, witty, and everyone who meets Bass comments on his sparkling intelligence. They're also from around the same part of the UK, around Lincolnshire. Apparently they work out quite early on that they're born about 11 miles from each other. And Bass, of course, is a surgeon, the same occupation as Flinders' father.
I'm sorry, ding, 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 ding. Daddy issues and a daddy who's good with his hands? Sign me up.
What is not to like? So Flinders later wrote of Bass, in Mr. George Bass, I had the happiness to find a man whose ardour for discovery was not to be repressed by any obstacles, nor deterred by any danger.
Okay. It feels to me like Flinders is getting pretty swept up in his affections for Bass.
You could say that.
Do we know how Bass felt about Flinders?
It could be a situation of one person loving and the other person letting love.
We've all been there.
Sounds a little one-sided at this point. I've read Bass's letters as well. He is probably someone who you would imagine as more of a 19th century guy than an 18th century guy. He's not particularly effusive in his expressions of sentiment. I've read his letters to his wife. They're all on the side of the wife. Very little on the side of Bass. That could also suggest something else. But we don't know. The Reliance arrives in Port Jackson in September 1795. They are getting along famously, and they hatch a plan to complete an examination of the east coast of New South Wales together, which I think is probably the naval equivalent of let's go on a date and let's just trial moving in together.
So they're buying a Subaru.
If they were lesbians, they'd be buying a Subaru.
Yeah.
Or, Lee, is it Brokeback Mountain on the high seas? Who knows? So Flinders and Bass then have a few fun little adventures in a very small boat, about 3 metres long, that they call the Tom Thumb. And it's just those two and Bass's servant boy, William Martin.
I think I've seen this movie.
So first they explore and map the Georges River and encourage Governor Hunter to form a colony there, which he does, and he calls You guessed it. Bankstown.
Oh, so this is the patronage you were telling us about before.
That's it.
Yeah.
Slightly sycophantic. The next expedition is in another small boat that they also call the Tom Thumb. It starts disastrously from Shark's Bay with them realising that they'd put the fresh water into the wine canisters and it's now undrinkable.
They feel very distracted to me. I feel like they're in a romantic flap.
They are in a romantic flap. <They're> quite distracted by each other, possibly. Mm-hmm. When they try to go ashore near Wollongong, the boat nearly crashes into the reef and ends up waterlogged. More romantic flap. Flinders said, and I quote him, "So we all ended up having to sleep in the boat together." Very small boat, 3 metres long, the three of them tucked in there together. I'll leave you to imagine that.
I am.
There's another very steamy section of Flinders' journal where he describes Bass having to take all his clothes off and going ashore and trying to save their waterlogged food and possessions.
It feels like Flinders is paying a lot of attention to Bass's body.
Yeah. Anyway, there they are. They've got waterlogged food. They're on shore and they're actually saved. And this is a story that we hear over and over again in colonial history. They are saved by a local Indigenous group who feed them and show them where the fresh water is. And in exchange, another story that we hear a lot in colonial history, Flinders sets up a barbershop or of sorts. He offers some beard trimming.
Wow. Okay.
And that's something that he would likely have seen in other moments of culture contact in Australia and around the Pacific. I know that William Dawes, the astronomer, he's constantly trimming the beards of Bennelong and various other Aboriginal people.
So this is like a pattern of cultural exchange or, you know, encounter or something that the British are using everywhere? Is that?
Yeah, it's interesting. They're working out, I think, in Australia what Aboriginal people like and don't like. Mm-hmm. And beard trimming, that gets a tick.
Yeah. Look, you know, you're telling me a story here where Flinders and Bass, you know, they're sounding a little incompetent. Waterlogged ships, running aground. Doesn't he circumnavigate the continent, though? How do we get there?
Absolutely, Lee, you're right. But before he does that, he circumnavigates Tasmania.
Oh.
So at this stage, it's 1798, and Flinders, who now we call Lieutenant Flinders, is able to command his own boat in that status, and he sails all the way around Tasmania, which is then known as Van Diemen's Land, proving that it was an island. Who did he bring along? Bass, of course. In fact, they concocted the idea of circumnavigating Tasmania together. Bass had just returned from a voyage around the area. So Flinders really thrills to his role as a captain in this period, and he's known for his firmness, his fairness, and his scientific brilliance. When Flinders does his sketches of the shoreline, Bass takes over the sloop, and together they both conduct investigations as naturalists. That could be collecting species of eucalypts, dissecting wombats. They're two really curious, possibly bi-curious, as we've mentioned, lads, who are really thrilling to the adventure of exploration. So while Flinders never named anything after himself, he did give names to 348 places around Australia, including naming the passage between mainland Australia and Tasmania. Guess?
Bass. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Bass Strait.
Bass not so straight.
Yeah, I grew up in Melbourne. I did not realise I was living near a huge body of water named for a romantic relationship between men.
A grand celebration of fluidity.
Right.
Lee, absolutely.
Of course, Alicia, you and I know, as probably do our listeners, these places were part of Indigenous geographies. They had their own names. There were thousands and thousands of year-old Indigenous lifeways and stories about these places, which these men were just kind of writing over the top of.
Absolutely. And there is actually a moment where the Imperial Office in London says, "Enough George's sounds, enough King George blah, blah." Yep. Like, there are too many places in the empire that are being named after either patrons or the monarchy. Give them Indigenous names.
Yeah.
And so that does happen at some point.
And I remember from my own work on the 19th century British Empire, you know, these big imperial conflicts. So there's famous generals who have streets in every imperial city named after them. So it kind of makes sense to me that the Colonial Office would be saying, like, let's
you know, come up with something that's local. We have that, Woolloomooloo in Sydney. There's Indigenous place names all around Sydney, actually, that are very, very old. I have always had a hunch, and this is just a read, right, that it feels much safer to give a place its Indigenous place name if Indigenous people aren't there anymore. Like, if you've taken full possession of the land, it is much safer to name it after an Indigenous word than it is for someone like Flinders to acknowledge that these places have Indigenous names. He's taking possession of the continent. He's making it British. There's a much lower stakes move of saying, oh, yeah, there was some Indigenous people here, but they're not here anymore, which kind of tends to happen later in the colonisation story.
Yeah, I think you're right. It does. It coincides with that shift in imperial policy as well, where they are now happy with expansion and with settlement.
Yeah.
You know, they're no longer debating that.
Yeah. Now, back to high school history here. If memory serves, Flinders was one of the first people to name this continent in its entirety Australia, I think.
Yeah. In the very least, he was a primary proponent, you know, and popularizer.
Yep.
He was a great popularizer of the name Australia. And he used it to describe the entire continent in his 1814 book, A Voyage to Terra Australis. So the western part was known as New Holland. The eastern part is known as New South Wales when Flinders is there. But Flinders advocated for Australia as a term to describe the entire continent in its unity. So Flinders returns to Britain in 1800. But before he returns, he pens that letter to Bass,
right,
which we opened the episode with. There was a time when I was so completely wrapped up in you that no conversation but yours could give me any degree of pleasure. So in the same letter, he says of his friend Wiles, and remember, Wiles is the guy who he travels on the breadfruit voyage with, he says about him, he says, and yet it is not clear to me that I love you entirely. And so by that, he's talking to Bass. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, it's not clear to me that I love you entirely. At least my affection for Wiles reaches farther into my heart. I would take him into the same skin with me.
Okay, I'm sorry. But this is so hot.
It's really hot. Look, Bass's wife saw this letter and wrote, and we've got this almost in caps lock, this is written by a man with a very bad character.
Oh, wow. You know, my first reading here is jealous. But you mentioned before that in some ways, you know, Bass and maybe his wife are sort of more at home in a 19th century sensibility rather than an 18th century one. So for someone from a 19th century sensibility, someone being so effusive towards another man would be highly suspicious and suspect, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that historians who have looked at these letters, and chief among them is Paul Brunton, who was the senior curator of Sydney's Mitchell Library, he rejects the homosexuality hypothesis, right? So he says, he told The Age when the letters were first published, it would be immensely difficult to have a sexual relationship on those boats and keep it quiet. I liken it to the mateship of the Anzacs.
Okay, I'm sorry. Hold up. We know there is a deep and long history of men's kind of sociability in military contexts, whether it's, you know, our treasured Anzacs or people in the British Army or the Navy kind of sliding from these intense homosocial, so male-only environments into kind of homosexual dynamics. That's why these homosocial environments are so interesting to us, I think. I'm not convinced by Brunton's claim.
But what do you really think, Lee? Like, am I imagining something that's in fact not there?
Well, I don't think either you or I are actually imagining that we can call Matthew Flinders a homosexual, right?
Definitely not.
What we're trying to think about is what to do with a set of relations and ways of relating to other men, not just Bass, there was other men as well, that seem to us to be erotically charged, tender, full of feeling, and that suggest these are really serious relationships for Flinders. And I don't think we're imagining something that's not there. I think the mistake that we might make is to label that being a homo.
Absolutely. In so many ways, it's actually what 18th century masculinity is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a time that valued sentiment. It valued affectionate relationships between men without that necessarily being a suspect category of relationship. Matthew Flinders took friendship seriously. Mm. And I'd say for women as well, intimacy was far broader and far more fluid, and friendships often had an erotic charge to them. So an example of that with women is Jane Addams and Mary Rosette Smith, who were two social reformers in America. When Addams travelled without Smith, she'd lug along an enormous portrait of her friend with her to hang above her bed.
Fun.
You know, friendship for them is a very intense bond. It's not a pit stop on the way to marriage.
Yeah, okay.
We don't live in that world. Yep. We live in a world where marriage is privileged over friendship. That is absolutely not the case in the 18th century.
Yeah, and that's not to say that every single late 18th century naval man got as carried away as Matthew Flinders did.
To be honest, George Bass's letters have none of the exuberance of Matthew's.
But it is to say that there was space, culturally and socially, for someone like Flinders to exist, to express himself, his masculinity and his attachments in this way, and it not call into question in the least his social standing, his the idea that he was going to have a wife and children.
Absolutely.
You know, I hear these stories and I'm like, oh, were they getting it on? But actually that's obviously not a question that anyone in the 18th century is asking.
Bring back that world.
Yeah. I kind of live in it now. It's a lot of fun.
Look, I'm going to be going home today to write a torrid letter to you, Lee, inspired by Bass and Flinders.
Alicia, I can't wait to receive it.
Next on The Dead Can't Sue, we promised to share sexy letters from Flinders to cats, his swords, wives. Whoop, yep, he does have a wife.
Wow.
Friends and many other things beside as we finish his story. So if you know someone who loves history or gossip or just two historians letting loose in an ABC studio, then share The Dead Can't Sue with them. Go on.
The Dead Can't Sue is an ABC Audio Studios podcast made on the land of the Kulin Nation and on Gadigal Country.
It's produced by supervising producer Hannah Riesch with executive producers Claire Rawlinson and Eric George. Beverly Wang was the development producer and Jessica Radburn is the head of audio on demand. Engineering by Ross Richardson. We've chucked a bunch of links to our sources in the show notes, so go on, do some further reading. We dare you.
I'm Lee Boucher, Associate Professor at Macquarie University.
And I'm Alicia Simmons, Associate Professor at UTS.
See you next time for some more gossip about the dead.